All right, we will call this committee meeting to order. This is the Wednesday, March 20th, 2013 meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. Members, we have four bills on the agenda. And we hope to get through all of them efficiently so that, in fact, we don't go into this evening. In fact, we can't go into this evening because there are no committee rooms available to us. And this committee room is taken promptly after our committee meeting has adjourned. So with that, I'll also mention that the fourth bill is for discussion, and we will lay it on the table. But it's a good transition bill because, of course, when we come back from the break, we are going to be transitioning to a finance committee, and that bill has more to do with budget matters than policy. And so when we come back from the break on April 3rd, we're going to dive right in. Budget and Bonding Committee. We're going to try to run that process efficiently as well so they're not pulling late hours after we come back from the break. So with that, committee members, we will commence with the first bill on the agenda, Senator Wieger. Welcome to the committee, Senate File 934.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate File 934 is a consumer protection measure designed to prevent stolen vehicles from being sold for scrap. Thousands of cars are stolen annually in Minnesota. Law enforcement's able to recover most of them. Unfortunately, a few hundred, don't know the exact amount, are processed into scrap very quickly. The intent of this bill is to provide more transparency for disclosure before that vehicle is scrapped, and we have a number of provisions in here to address it. I also have an amendment, A4, if I could move it to put it in the shape. It's not the committee of origin, but if we could move the A4, we get closer to the goal of unanimity.
Senator Wieger moves the A4, and members' quorum is present. So, Senator Wieger, could you describe the amendment, and then we'll vote on it?
Mr. Chair, members, what I'd like to do is go to Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, who can put the amendment in the context of the whole bill, or to Paul Cassidy.
Welcome, Mr. Cassidy.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, members, Paul Cassidy with law firm of Leonard Street and Dinard. I'm here on behalf of the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries. Amendment in front of you, first of all, deletes Section 5, and Section 5 is the provision that was in here for the automobile theft prevention account. The Commerce Department would prefer that we not include that in this bill and that we have a discussion later on how to provide restitution to auto theft victims, like the ones we're talking about today. Page 4 on line 2, we have deleting the new language, salvage pools. Salvage pools are business-to-business transactions, and what we're trying to address here, we don't believe would happen in that type of transaction. Page 6, delete sections 10 and 11. 10 and 11 has to do with the creation of Section 10, first of all, is provincial local ordinances. We still don't have an agreement on that. And Section 11 is actually a committee being put together over the interim to talk about how to create a searchable electronic database for law enforcement and have that interact with current reporting, which has to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles and also the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System.
Very good.
Thank you.
Any questions on the A4 amendment, members? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want the record to reflect that I'm going to recuse myself from all voting on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Miller. To the A4 members, we do have a quorum. Yes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes.
And, Mr. Senator Chair, Wieger, if I could ask John Choi, Ramsey County Attorney, to briefly address the merit of the bill.
County Attorney Choi. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's good to be here as a part of this process as you are processing and thinking through the issues in Senate File 934. This issue has been, we've been working on this issue since last year, and there is dispute between the law enforcement industry and the scrap metal industry about how best to resolve some of the issues. I wanted to first start with just so that all of you understand from the law enforcement perspective what we're trying to accomplish with respect to this legislation. This issue came to my attention in the summer of 2011 when we in St. Paul uncovered a large criminal scheme in which there were criminals who had access to tow trucks or were just stealing cars, but what they were doing was they were essentially taking these stolen cars, and sometimes these cars were stolen right out of people's driveways, which was just very shocking to me, and taken to the scrapyard. And in some cases, these cars were driven to the scrapyard. And for me, I thought that would be a red flag. Why would anybody want to scrap a fully operational vehicle? And then as we uncovered an investigation, there was just a lot of things that we felt that were lacking, one of which was, and these criminals were targeting the older vehicles because they're heavier and they would return more money from a scrapyard. But the law as it currently exists today is that if your car is more than 6 years of age, you don't need to prove that you own that vehicle by showing some sort of title or some other document that would indicate ownership. What the law currently requires for those vehicles is that you just sign an affidavit stating that it's your vehicle. And so that was one of the big problems that we saw. We also felt that as a part of really making a difference for these crime victims, and these cases are so sad because, you know, when you've got people without economic means, their car being stolen, a lot of these individuals don't have comprehensive automobile insurance. So when their car is stolen and scrapped, they're out of luck, and they don't have a few thousand dollars to get a new vehicle. And so one of the things to try to recover these vehicles for victims and to really hold these criminals accountable, we need more time to catch for so that the investigation could catch up to these criminals, because these cars were being scrapped within a matter of hours. I mean, these cars get processed, and before you know it, the forklift takes it, and they're scrapped. And that's too late. And so we feel like we need to have some time to be able to do the investigation. There's also a number of other things that we're trying to deal with respect to this bill. However, we also recognize that the scrap metal industry, they're good people, and there's a lot of people who are abiding by the law. And so we don't want to take a sledgehammer and do harm to the industry. And so it's important for me and the law enforcement community that is here with me today, and I know for the legislature, for us to really figure out a way to resolve these issues. And I really do feel hopeful that this year we will be able to get to a resolution. Quite frankly, we're all very tired because we've been working at this for quite some time, and I think we're making some good progress this year. With respect to the bill that is before you, Senate File 934, it is for the most part the industry's best effort, good faith effort, to come to resolution on some of these issues. Now, for we don't agree with much of what's in the bill. However, this is a very important first step, because what it represents is a recognition that the way that they've got this bill set up in Senate File 934 is that it recognizes that in order to scrap a vehicle, you have to have a title or you have to have some sort of document that proves ownership. And so we think that's a good step. And this, by the way, was the first time we were able to get something in writing. The House file, that version is the version that the law enforcement industry is very excited about. But our hope is that through working with the law enforcement community, scrap metal industry, and also our friends in Sherburne County also have a number of issues that they've recognized where they've got people stealing farm irrigators out from the farm, which is just absolutely shocking. And so we need to figure out a way to deal with those issues as well, and we'd like to try to incorporate all of that as a part of a compromise. And so as this bill progresses, these discussions will continue, and I do believe my sincere hope is that we could come to a resolution and have a good way to have reform, do right by crime victims, give us more ability to hold criminals accountable, not place undue or unfair burdens on the industry.
Thank you, County Attorney Choi. Any questions, members? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I want to mention is that if they kept the irrigation equipment intact and tried to sell it, our local folks and most anybody else would figure it out right away. The problem is it's not. It's pulled apart. Yeah. And so it's not like you can look at it and say, this is what it is. Not only that, it's thrown on a pile. So this isn't quite so simple as a iPad or a watch or something else that is readily identifiable, or even you might say a car where you have a VIN number. So they are very, very distinct and very, very different, though the issue is much the same as well. The concern I have is putting a burden on. One of the things I liked in this particular language you just took out, which was the auto theft victims whose vehicle was sold, that allows both the victims and the dealers to get some compensation when they've had something stolen, and you took that section out. I'm just curious as to why that would come out. Could you maybe answer that or address that?
Cassidy, Senator Wieger.
Mr. Cassidy will tell us why and why we hope this is in progress. But go ahead.
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, a couple of things. First of all, we're racing towards a 11:59 deadline, committee deadline on Friday night. That's number one. Number two, there's a larger discussion going on around auto theft right now that I think County Attorney Choi is involved in as well as I am on behalf of insurers. And the auto theft account over the years has been, for lack of a better description, raided a number of times. And now they're trying to figure out how to get it back on its feet. We thought this would encroach on that effort right now, but we agree that there probably needs to be some type of restitution account or something needs to exist in law, and maybe that's this year, maybe next, but it needs to be addressed because there are some compelling stories that come out of these stolen autos.
I think Mr. County Chairman. Attorney had a response as well.
Sure, that would be great. Right. That would be great, Mr.
County
Chairman.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, there is a bill pending that was referred to Finance Committee, Senator Metzen's bill. But in that bill, there is money that $1.3 million that is going to be transferred back into the auto theft fund. The House language, it hasn't been added to the bill, but it will be added today in committee. But there will be $100,000 transferred to the Department of Public Safety's victim account so that auto theft victims could get access to some of those monies, especially that situation where they don't have comprehensive insurance and then they're going to the impound lot or to retrieve their car. This is the worst part of it in
yes.
auto theft. They got to pay an impound fee to get their car back. And so that's something that we're working on, and perhaps some of those issues could be worked in as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, this is just something that I always find atrocious. There will be the courts will want a fee, and other people want a fee, and they all get a fee. But the true victim, the one who had their car stolen, has to pay to recover their own property. So I was encouraged by this. So I'm glad to hear that maybe there's some effort afoot elsewhere, and that even though this particular section is removed, but I understand this is more about the car one, not the other issue. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Anything further, members? Senator Wieger, anything further?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd move that Senate File 934 as amended be recommended pass and re-referred to Judiciary.
Senator Wieger, let me call for further testimony. I see at least one person is indicating a desire to come to the table. Mr. Tennyson, former Senator Tennyson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robert Tennyson. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I represent the Insurance Auto Auctions, which is a salvage pool. We're grateful for the amendment that was made to Section 6, which strikes the includes salvage pool because it doesn't work here. I still have a question about, and I've raised this with counsel and with Paul Cassidy, what the language means in Clause E of Section 6. By deleting the words motor vehicle parts, I understand what that does. That brings in the motor vehicle parts dealers under the Act. I don't have a problem with that. The problem I have is with the resale. We're not quite sure what that means in this context because we're talking about wholesale and the retail. And I don't know whether that brings in and now suddenly includes auto licensed auto dealers, new car and used car. My client is also licensed as a used car dealer, and I don't know what – it's unclear what this does because you're going to have a double negative. And for resale, you know, there's no definition in this act of what that really means, but apparently it means there's a, it has to imply that there's a wholesaler involved in this process somehow. And I'm not. I think you have to work through the details of this act to figure out how it works, because I think you may be expanding it, including things you really don't want to do. I don't have a good suggestion for you because I don't have haven't done the research to understand that properly.
Mr. Tennyson, maybe I didn't catch your inquiry, or maybe Senator Wieger can help respond, but it says that it does not include those folks.
Yeah, the way it was written, Mr. Chairman of the committee, was that it does not include persons engaged exclusively in the business of buying and selling new and used motor vehicles. That's fine. That's the way it was written. They were not included. But when you add the clause for resale, then it raises some other questions about which dealers, or whether you're dealing with wholesalers or retailers. I don't know the answer to that. I think there needs more work on that to get an answer so that you don't have an unintended consequence of this act, which may cost some people a lot of hype.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tennyson, former senator, at line 4.4, if we deleted for resale.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think that solves the problem because it doesn't create the ambiguity.
I would so move.
Thank you.
Right. but Senator Wieger, continue to keep or motor vehicle parts stricken.
Delete the section.
Mr. Chair, I could yield to counsel. I'm getting counsel from the drafters of the amendment, but I believe we only added the words for resale. And I thought Senator Tennyson indicated if we deleted that.
All right, we'll just do that. Okay, so Senator Wieger moves that we strike the words the new words for resale on line 4.4. Questions, members?
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't you just delete the section then? I don't think anything is left.
Well, the words or motor vehicle parts are stricken from current language.
Okay.
So the section goes
which Senator Wieger indicated he wanted to keep.
Stays out.
Thank you. All right. Ready to vote? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. All right. Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 934?
Yes, I would.
Please come to the table. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Senator Dibble. I want to speak on behalf of the impound lot experience. I had the unfortunate. My name
yourself?
Is David Sweet, and I work as an advocate for our veterans, Operation Sweet Christmas. I had an experience where my car was towed because they had changed the rules that after 10 o'clock on a Friday night you couldn't park on 4th Street, which, you know, I've been gone for 10 years, and I couldn't imagine after 10 o'clock that you couldn't park. But I was surprised when I went to the impound lot that the individual that was driving me to my car was severely intoxicated. And as a comedy writer, I couldn't believe this because obviously if you're going to drink and drive, where a better place to drink and drive than in the impound lot because where are they going to tow your car? So I immediately called 911 to alert the police and showed that the gentleman, the card from one of my associates was an FBI agent, and mentioned that it seemed a little bit, you know, odd
Mr.
that, you know,
Mr.
we
Sweet,
have people.
Please, to the bill.
As far as to the bill goes, I would my suggestion is that we have an outside audit of how these impound lots are taking fees in these conditions where the cars are stolen, and if we can ensure that they're not, you know, doing these other kind of practices.
All right. Thank you. Senator Wieger, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes.
Senator Wieger moves Senate File 934 as amended to be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Wieger. All right. What's next? Senator Reinert, Senate File 871.
It's your bill?
Oh, we can take it if you want.
You're just trying to get to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, as you can tell from the thickness of my bill folder, this is a very difficult, very complicated bill. Here to tell you all about it is Bob Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. This this one change in Senate File 871 is actually a carryover from a salvage title bigger bill that was passed in the 2012 session. It was a joint initiative of the Alliance of Auto Service Professionals, the collision repair shops. Kevin Wally represents them. He can't be here today. And we had one section of the bill. This language change has been endorsed by the Department of Public Safety. We dropped it out last year because there was a slight fiscal note to it. And so it's updating, frankly, a 20-year-old law that has a dollar amount in it that should be updated. So that's the change from $5,000 to $9,000. So it's supported by the agency. It's supported by the industries involved. And we'd encourage your support for the bill.
And, Mr. Chair,
I'm just seeing
this fiscal note for the first time. So I don't know if we have somebody who wants to speak to it, but as the author, I'm getting it at the table.
I'm Senator Reiner, just seeing it for the first time myself. Ms. Boyd, any insight into the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and Senator Reiner, yes, I apologize. I just got this fiscal note as well. It's speaking to the assumptions by the department that there will be 50% fewer high value vehicle inspections since the threshold will be raised on what a high value vehicle is, and that will be a loss in the fee revenue from the inspections, I believe, to the general fund and to the special revenue fund, $30,000 to the general fund and $22.5 to the special revenue fund.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Boyd.
All right. Questions, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 871? Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, Senator Reiner will probably need to send this to Finance. All right. Do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move approval of 871, recommend approval, and move to Finance.
Thank you. Any questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Reiner. Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senate File 607.
Yeah, right. I heard my voice. Testifier table, yep.
Senator
Chair,
Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I think we have some handouts also.
And there are a few items in the packet. There are more coming around. Something from the League of Minnesota Cities.
There should be a couple of, Mr. Chair, a couple of testimonies from two cities that are in support, and
right.
Also a graph.
right. We'll have those passed out.
Get them here.
Oh.
Sorry. All we have is the graph.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Senate File 607 is a bill that gives local control to municipalities where they are able to, by ordinance, adopt a street municipal street improvement district. Again, this is not a mandate. It is permission for cities to do this. The district would use the funds to defray the costs of street improvements and maintenance. They would apply to all property located in the district, and the costs must be uniformly apportioned to all the property based on classification. Before establishing the district, the city must adopt a street improvement plan identifying the location of the district with estimates of the total cost. Fees may only be collected for 5 to 20 years. There must be a public hearing on the plan regarding the plan where it affected and where the affected landowners may testify. We have supporters from in my two cities, the city of Eagan and the city of Burnsville, are both strong supporters. We also had a council member from the city of Northfield testify. And I have the mayor of the city of White Bear Lake, Joe Emerson, here to help me with this, and also Lee Gunderson, the director of engineering for the city of Minnetonka. This is something where we have had major input from the League of Minnesota Cities, and it has support from the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, and North Metro Mayors, the Minnesota Transportation Alliance, the City Engineers Association of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Chapter of the American Public Works Association. And one of the benefits here is that this would be a street improvement and maintenance fund that could be used to preserve streets. And for most cases, when you preserve something, preserve an asset, it lasts longer. So there's the possibility of having actually a reduction in street costs, even for those nonprofits that would get assessed this fee, but would not be assessed generally for street fees via their taxes and by a levy. But would be assessed as if a street is rebuilt. And what's recently been found is that some cities, when they assess these fees, they have to prove a benefit to the property owner, and that gets to be difficult sometimes or questionable and has led to a lot of needless lawsuits. This would hopefully eliminate any kind of problem like that. With me today, I think we'll have Mr. Gustafson tell you about the City of Minnetonka's plans for this.
Chair and members of the committee,
please introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Lee Gustafson. I'm the engineering director for the City of Minnetonka. I'm also here representing the City Engineers Association of Minnesota and the American Public Works Association of Minnesota chapter. On behalf of City of Minnetonka and these associations, I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. My initial comments will refer to that handout that was just circulated here, and it's really illustrating the cost savings of doing proper maintenance or doing the right repair at the right time on roads. Roads are no different than your own home, or especially if you want to just think about the roof on your house. When you do the repairs, when you do the patching and the replacement at the right time, there's significant savings by doing those repairs when they're needed and not waiting on them. Obviously, when you wait on doing your roof repair, significant damage can occur to the structural components of your house and also to the interior. Roads are no different. If you do the repairs at the right time, significant savings can be received by doing the repairs at the right time. Roads are some people don't think of as an asset or an investment, but they're one of a city's biggest investments that they have. So doing proper maintenance at the right time saves and maintains this investment for the taxpayers. And studies have shown, as you can see on this graph, that if you wait on maintenance, your costs significantly go up for each year that you don't do any maintenance. And studies have shown that for every dollar spent on maintenance, you can save $7 in repairs. It simply comes down to road authorities having the proper funding tools to do the right repair at the right time. You're going to hear some opposition to this bill that will say you can specially assess for everything or even use tax abatements for maintenance. It's simply not true. Maintenance activities such as patching and crack sealing and overlay, they have very few funding sources. Also, you may hear that special assessments will take care of everything. In my opinion, it doesn't work for maintenance because there's very few funding sources. It does, however, work in many other applications. But special assessments do add cost to each and every project. Special assessment takes time to prepare the assessment rolls to prove benefit and actually have the assessment rolls certified at the county. And specially assessing a project does add time to a project and can delay a project, where sometimes it can actually drive the cost up. It can also be troublesome from business owners and homeowners because for somebody that just moves in, you may get hit with a huge assessment shortly after moving in. The proposed legislation before you maximizes the maintenance dollars for every road jurisdiction. It doesn't waste any money by administering detailed assessments. It's also a pay-as-you-go system, so you pay a little bit each year for the time that you use the roads or the time that you live within that city or have your business within that city. The fees are also tax-deductible, unlike special assessments. It clearly saves the taxpayer money by not having when you compare it to special assessments. The street improvement districts that are identified within the legislation are required, the cities are required to have a special account where that money goes into. It can only be used for improvements within that district. You can't collect money in one district and build a park in another district. It's clearly dedicated money that stays within that district. So residents and property owners and business owners within that district are assured that the money that's collected within their district goes to maintain the roads within the district that they're collected. In a quick summary, the proposed legislation provides a needed funding mechanism for maintenance activities. It's clearly easier and cheaper for taxpayers when you compare it to special assessments. It's a simple pay-as-you-go system, so you don't get hit with large special assessments. And once again, the funds collected are dedicated, and they stay within those improvement districts. Taking care of streets are important to all of us. We want to do it so we save the taxpayers money. We also want to do it so it's done at the right time for the right reason. And this proposed legislation provides a funding mechanism for cities that will allow this to occur. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions at this time or be available for questions afterwards.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Carlson.
Now I'd like to have Mayor Joe Emerson from White Bear Lake, your perspective.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Joe Emerson. I'm the mayor of White Bear Lake. I've noticed when we've been doing our street projects and when we have our meetings for the public to come and comment, we're seeing a lot more people aging in place. And one large assessment for them is a lot for them to handle. They're on fixed incomes. They want to stay in their homes. We want them to stay in their homes. But it's becoming a burden. Also, it's becoming a burden for our young families that are moving into the community. They've bought a house, and they're stretched, and they're trying to take care of everything. I think this type of district would enable them to pay a small fee. It could be put on the utility bill. It could be quarterly, semiannual, whatever. I mean, that all those things could be worked out. But I think it's similar to the legislation on sidewalk districts that I think it's Section 435 of the Minnesota statutes. It's a similar proposal. I think it's a fair and equitable way for everyone to be a part of this, and I think I just think it's a better way. We have to look at new ways. It's something that isn't going to be mandated, which is people will like that. It's an enabling legislation, and people will like the fact if a city wants to do this, they can. If they don't, they don't have to. I think that is a very crucial piece of this also. I don't have much more to say except I support this bill, and I hope you will consider it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Emerson. Questions, members? Senator Osmick, and then Senator Kiffmeyer, and then Senator Central. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the mayor. I understand your point on aging populations. The city I live in actually has the same sort of situation. But to the question here on these districts, whether you assess for it. We've been involved in street projects since 2003. We use a unit method. We don't use square street footage. There's a lot of different methods you can use. If you're assessing someone and you have that put it on their tax bill for, I think it's up to 15 years, or you have a 15-year project area, aren't you really doing the same thing in both cases? You may say that it's a small fee, but whether you're splitting up a $2,000 cost over 15 years through a street assessment or you're doing it over 15 years on this fee method, is that not the same way you're getting to the same ending?
Yes, it is, Senator. Mayor. But in a lot of cases, I think it's more palatable to them to have a smaller fee over a period of time than this large assessment sitting out there. They're from a generation that doesn't like to owe, and I think that sometimes plays into this.
Okay. Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, in response to that question, the special assessment is also lean on the property as well. And the question also assumes that property owner lives in that house for 15 to 20 years. Many times we don't have that case now with our young families. They're moving. So if they're only in that house for 5 years, they get hit with a very large special assessment that typically has to get paid off before they sell. The pay-as-you-go is very simply paying a little bit each year for the years that they live in that residence.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmond.
And to that point, you're correct. However, a smart home seller is going to build that into their prices to know very well that they have an existing lien over their house. So while I agree that they may have a lien that they have to pay off, they also can build it into the price that by which they sell their property. So that I understand your pay as you go. I guess I would like to ask a question of Senator Carlson. In looking at this legislation, are you able to pre-tax people for the project? In other words, can you initiate the project, be collecting all the fees, and then not start the project until the council decides they wish to take the project underway? Or do you have to initiate the project immediately and be assessing the fees at the same time?
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, this would be a fund that you would support. It's not necessarily project related. This would be a fund for maintenance and for improvements that would be payable as soon as one moves into the home. Now, there is a provision in there for new homes that suspends the fees for the first few years. So, yes, it would be something that would be a fund. Many of the cities that have been doing this by levy have put together a fund, and then they spend out of that fund. For instance, the city of Burnsville has done this before. So it's a fund that is, Burnsville calls it their street trust, but it's not really a trust, but they do spend out of that fund. So it's something to make sure that there's pay-as-you-go money.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmond.
To Senator Carlson's comment then, so let me get the, just so I understand this. So you can create the district. It can be as large as you want and as small as you want. You don't have to say what the project's going to be. You can just generically say for this precinct, let's just use a subsection of a city, using the whole city is obvious, but let's say for this particular precinct, you want to initiate this. You don't necessarily have to have a plan. You can just start feeing them as much as you want under this plan until you deem that you have a project you want to do, correct?
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond. No, there is a plan to, to some regard, where most cities have a street plan and a street maintenance plan, so they know what it costs. And plus, before establishing this, you have to have a street plan. That is a requirement of the the city that's going to initiate this according to the legislation. So it's not like there's no plan. It's not like there's a major project that they would start funding today, because you know you're not going to be able to pay as you go if you're going to be replacing an entire street. That's for a different mechanism. Yes, you would sometimes have a balance, and you would sometimes perhaps go down to zero as you do your street plan. In the city of Egan, they have a plan for every street. They know how long it's going to last. They know what the lifetime is. They know what the service life, all the service life can be improved if they do certain maintenance procedures on it, for instance, seal coating and other things like that. So it's not like there's no plan at all. There's every city has a street plan.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify that, you don't, you know, when we've done street projects in my previous life, we've said, okay, here's the street project. We have the hearing. We have the assessment hearing. We bill the people. So what you're saying is that you can create the district. You will have a street plan that can be as nebulous as you want, saying we're going to eventually overlay, we're going to eventually seal coat, we're going to eventually do all of these things, but you don't necessarily have to have a plan necessarily that is specific to a timeline to the actual services that are going to be rendered, correct?
Senator Carlson.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, I certainly wouldn't use the term nebulous, because it does say what you have to have, and in some cases, the district could be the entire city, and mm-hmm. It could be the entire city's plan. But if you're looking at a particular smaller area, a subsection of your city, the legislation does say you have to have the location of the municipal street improvement district and identify and estimate the costs of the proposed improvements. So, yes, you would have to have costs and the proposed improvements. And you do have to have a hearing, so you're going to have to satisfy the public also.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Carlson, because it was starting out very nebulous. We're getting a lot more specific, which is good. I do have a question. I don't know if it's for Ms. Berzovsky or not. The question is, the comment that was brought up was, is the fee tax deductible? And I know that things on my water bill may or may not be tax deductible, and and the comment was made that it is tax deductible. I don't know if that's accurate.
Ms. Finn from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Oh,
yes.
Wonderful.
Mr. Chair, Ann Finn from the League of Minnesota Cities. Senator Osmick, we actually have gotten an opinion from House Counsel on that very issue, and I can share that with you. I think I have a copy of it in my file here, but his opinion is that this would be deductible, whereas special assessments are not.
Okay. All right. Next I have...
Mr. Chair, can I just follow up on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Senator Centrum.
And this is just pure recollection, but as I understand, a stormwater utility fee is not tax deductible. And so I agree with the Senator Osmond. I just kind of wonder about this one.
Ms. Finn, if you could make that opinion available, we'll duplicate it and distribute it to the committee. Thanks. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Mr.
Thank you,
Senator. Where did that opinion come from?
House Counsel. House Counsel.
For the League of Minnesota Cities.
Mr. Chair, Senator Restick came from Joel Michael.
He doesn't work for the Department of Revenue, Mr. Chairman. I feel more comfortable if...
Well, Senator Rest, we'll look at the memo, and if you don't like what Mr. Michael has to say, we'll ask for something from the Department of Revenue.
Yeah,
I think this is going to end up in the Tax Committee at some point. Anyways, so, all right, ready to move on to Senator Kiffmeyer? All right, thanks.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I want to make is just a comment. You made a big point about the fact that these would be dedicated. Well, I assure you, the bill just before this, one of the sections had to do with a dedicated account on the car situation, and money was being taken from that dedicated account to be used for something else, of course, being done through statute. But I assure you, dedicated does not mean forever and ever and ever, never ever taken from that use or for something else. It does not. It gives me no comfort whatsoever to hear that. It's a great way to start, but that is so frequent around here in the legislature that those things start that way. The snowmobiles fund, the motorcycle fund, all kinds of funds over and over and over again. As a matter of fact, probably one of the biggest ones is our own school shift situations there where money was supposed to go and have a certain plan, and then things were changed. So just so we understand that that is certainly the case, and getting that undone afterwards is very difficult. One of my questions for you is, on the bottom line, though, for the taxpayers, I understand why a city or an entity, and I feel the squeeze. I'm in my district. You drive on those roads, and I know you feel that squeeze, and you're looking for ways to do that. But for your folks out there and the taxpayers, it seems as though they are already paying for this through their property taxes. Now there's going to be another fee on top of that property tax for the same thing they expect they're paying for today, and that is for maintenance, striping, all those kinds of things as a part of the course of their current payment of their property taxes. Wouldn't that be just like double dipping to the taxpayer? Maybe you can respond to that. Maybe I don't understand this clearly enough.
Well,
anyone can respond who would like to. Mayor?
Well, I think for some cities, it's been a struggle in this economy. They have had to let things like street maintenance go because they had to fund other things that were needed in the city, say public safety, whatever. I mean, it's been a struggle for some communities. Some have reserves and do it well, but there are some that this is hard for, and I think we need to look at them because it's a problem, and they need, you know, if they're going to survive and they're going to be viable, they're going to need to have these things, and they haven't been able to do it. Some have had to let their maintenance go. Mine is not one of them, but there are. I mean, I've been fortunate, but there are some that can't.
Thank
Mr.
you,
Chairman.
Senator Kevmeyer.
Yeah, I appreciate that, but I think of the taxpayers who are struggling. They're struggling, okay? And so here you are saying, well, we're struggling, but we're just going to put another fee on top of you to take out of your monthly checkbook. Another item to come out of your monthly checkbook that isn't going to go to clothing or maybe to repair their own roof because they might have deferred their own maintenance on their own homes, and they're trying to do that. And now here comes a situation where they're going to have another cost coming out of their family checkbook. So I just want to be a voice for that and in their situation. I would suspect that as the economy can recover, that will probably see some of your revenues in your cities or townships or counties recovering, because an economic recovery, just like we're seeing here in the state, already just in this next fiscal year, we have an additional 2.7% of revenues coming in this fiscal year. As a matter of fact, for 16-17 fiscal years, there's going to be probably a sum total of $4 billion above where we're at today. So economic recovery does generate increasing revenues without changing the underlying policy to state, local governments, and others. Well, if we just bide our time, but my concern is that the folks out there who are struggling are the ones that are going to pay this, and they have deferred maintenance as well. So in the end, this will. My other question is, I know we have local government aid, and the purpose of LGA is to help in that regard. I've seen some proposals already out there increasing LGA. Wouldn't this, in effect, be the solution that possibly you're – I mean, again, I'm looking at this double dipping, and the taxpayer is the one who's taking it on the chin here.
So, Senator Carlson, a couple of things to respond to.
Yeah, a couple of things. I think Senator Kiffmeyer, you're correct. Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, people are struggling. One thing we have to remember that's clearly written here, and it's on the chart that you got, is that this has a return on investment. it gives back $7 for every dollar that you put in with maintenance. That's something that this is the time to invest to avoid a larger problem later on. This is the kind of thing that the cities have clearly studied, and they are able to predict that maintenance and apply it at the right time to make their streets last longer. They can probably get 40 and 50 years out of a street instead of 20 to 30 years. So that's an important aspect of being able to fix things when it's time to fix things. And the other thing on the keeping the money away from, okay, us. You know, this is going to be held by the cities. It's not going to be held by the legislature. I don't know that the legislature can go in and steal a city account. So it's really keeping it away from us. The people in the cities are the ones that are going to have to stand for election. So this is a decision for them to make. If we don't know whether there's going to be an increase in LGA, we don't know whether there's going to be levy limits, we don't know all of those things that we do to the cities. This allows the cities to make their own decisions, to control their own destiny, their own city and street quality, and they have to stand for election, and they have to answer to their own residents whenever they start to push this. Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to follow up, though, that I think I don't take issue with the chart here where you say doing the work, all of that, not at all, not for the homeowner either, in regards to their return on investment and the fact that they now won't have the resources to invest in their own home or maintenance or their kids or other things that they've got going on as well. And if the legislature is making the law, the legislature can change the law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. I have Senator, where did my list go? Senator Senjum, then Peterson, and then Jensen. Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, my question got answered.
Okay,
I may have one later, but
all right. Well, we do have to move on to another bill, so don't save up too many questions. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Carlson, and or anyone on the panel that maybe the answer to the question. One thing that comes to mind here, you know, certainly our economy is starting to recover and we're starting to see some development again. Is there anything in this bill I was trying to find here that might protect a developer that's working on a new development? I think of a housing development, for example, that might have 60 lots in it, and the developer pays some of the street fees and that type of thing to get the development opened up, the curb and gutter in, the first layer of bituminous, that type of thing. And they might only sell, the first year they might sell 10 lots. Is there anything that would protect that developer from a municipality coming in and then setting up one of these districts, you know, while that developer still owns, you know, 40 of the lots and there's only 10 of the lots sold, and I see them getting billed again immediately for the vacant lots because they're still the owner. And so, you know, from that perspective, one way I could see in terms of protecting that type of new development and encouraging that new development within your community would be to have some type of time period that exempts those folks from a municipal street improvement. Is there anywhere in the bill that protects that now?
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Peterson, Ann, would you like to answer that question? Yes, there is a protection in the bill.
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, we actually worked with the Builders Association of Minnesota to put together some language given their concerns about that very issue. And you'll see in Subdivision 9, starting on line 3.10, there's some language there that we've all agreed upon. It essentially says that a city cannot incorporate a parcel into a district unless it's occupied, and if it's a new construction, then they can't start collecting fees from that property for 3 years after occupation.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, somebody can help me with this. I'm looking at Subdivision 4, adoption of the plan. And if I'm understanding this correctly, they can't, the city municipality sees that there needs to be work in a certain area that's been deferred or something, and then you make it a district and you present that plan. So this could be the fee that's assessed is going to be based on whatever that plan is. Am I understanding this correctly?
Chair and Senator Jensen, that's correct.
Okay, so
be based on the plan. The fee would be based on the plan.
Okay, so if you have more districts in your city, all those fees will be based on whatever that specific plan is for that area.
Senator Jensen, that's correct.
And they'll also be paying their property taxes that will go for the levy that the city has established, then for the maintenance of the rest of the city. I guess I'm kind of getting to Senator Kiffmeyer's point. I'm kind of struggling a little bit with when a city, a municipality, does their budget and has what they're going to do for their maintenance, whether it's deferred or whatever, the general money that you collect is used to pay that. Now you're going to have, I hope I'm understanding this right, you're going to have separate accounts for different sections throughout the city based on hearings and your plan.
Well, Senator Jen, this would be in lieu of special assessments when street improvements are made to a particular, to your own street in front of your house.
Right, correct.
Most, if not all, cities then levy a special assessment to your property. You would avoid that in this instance. You don't pay for. You pay your property taxes. Some of that goes for just kind of general upkeep of the roads. But then when there's a significant project that comes in front of your house,
you pay
a special assessment. This would be in lieu of that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, so what you're saying is this would not be used for if there was deferred maintenance on the road, unless it was big enough. And do you understand my question? Maybe I'm not explaining it.
Senator Jensen,
Mr. Gustafson,
let me take a stab at that. the scenario you're describing is isolated districts, and versus the district over the whole city. That's why I'm reading your question here. City more than likely would have general maintenance built into their tax levy. That would be the crack ceiling and things like this. That would be applied citywide. Then within those districts, this money could then be paid for the street improvements, being more so of your significant overlays, your reconstructs, and things like this. But the general maintenance could be covered under the general tax levy of the city and applied citywide. And so then just the main improvements or the major improvements could be funded using the street improvement district.
I don't see that in this language.
Senator Jensen, that would be based on it's in the legislation based on the plan that the city develops. And the plan that the city develops would be based on some of those factors that I just mentioned. And it also would be that plan would be based on it would be long-term, and also be based, that plan would be presented at a hearing as well. So the taxpayers within that district could hear what improvements are being proposed within that district and understand that possibly in the case I mentioned that the crack ceiling and the minor maintenance would be within the general tax levy, and these major improvements could be funded through this street improvement district.
Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Gustafson, I think Senator Jensen's question is a fair one. Do we get to your point in the first section of the bill where improvements are defined as some of those more major elements that you describe? You have a definition of improvements, and those are some of the more major elements that you just described: construction, reconstruction, upgrades, paving, curbs, gutters, et cetera. And then, so that's in paragraph C on line 111. Then paragraph D on line 1.22, maintenance means striping, seal coating, crack sealing, et cetera. Are the districts confined to improvements and not maintenance? I'm not reading fast enough to pick that up.
Chair Dibble? It allows for both. And I was trying, the Senator Jensen asked a question that was based on a scenario. My answers were based on that scenario.
Okay.
As you described, it applies to both situations. A street improvement district could be a citywide and include everything that you're just reading off on that first page.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But under the adoption of a plan, it says that the plan identifies the location, and then the property owners within that location would be notified. So it does look like my scenario is what's laid out in the language, that a specific section with specific landowners.
Mr. Chair, members.
Ms. Finn.
We have a very vast variety of cities in our state. We have 853 cities, and they would all they're all looking for ways to do the items that you see listed on this bill. What we're trying to provide is a tool to them that will give them some flexibility in how they fund different components. We've heard from the city of Sleepy Eye, for example, that they would probably have a citywide district. We've heard from some other cities that they would perhaps make their city into quadrants for purposes of a district so that they could deal with infrastructure of varying age. So what we're really trying to do here is give them another tool and give them enough flexibility so that they can decide how to use it in consultation with their residents and their businesses.
All right. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would say, going back to the point I made before, what really gives me concern is on page 3, line 5, where it says, the use of municipal street improvements fee by municipality does not restrict the municipality from imposing other measures to pay the costs of local street improvements or maintenance. You just can't use a special assessment, but you can use something else. So now you're going to have property taxes, a special street improvement district, and oh, by the way, that's not exclusive either. You can have something else. Maybe you'll call it a different name. That's my concern in regards to the language here today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer, because I think my concerns kind of go along the same line of thinking. What this says is that you can't impose an assessment for a project funded with a street improvement fee, but is there anything in the bill that precludes you from assessing someone in a street improvement district? And so we're effectively double-dipping on them. Or let me even take it a step further. Is it possible that you would put somebody in a special taxing district who's already paying for an assessment on a road that was built and theoretically should need little to no maintenance over the time that assessment's being paid down?
I think your question goes to line 3.8, must not impose special assessments. But I'm not sure.
Well, 3.8 says if you continue down, funded with the improvement fees. But that doesn't mean there couldn't be another project that then is assessed on top of that, nor does it say somebody who's already paying assessment couldn't also then be assessed a fee on top of it.
Thank you. Who would like to take a stab at that? Senator Carlson.
Well, I'm just saying, I think you have to understand, at least in my city, I'd be run out of town if we did something like this. Our citizens wouldn't put up with it. They make their position known very clearly, and it's very hard to do something like that in a community without the citizens being aware. They wouldn't stand for it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
And I think that's the crux of the whole discussion here, is that this brings the decision closest to the resident. The resident will get the chance to object or support this, and we do specify that there has to be a hearing. So it is probably as close to the resident as we can get. This is local control at its finest.
They will let you know.
All right. Thank you. I have Senator Westrom. Members, we do have additional testimony awaiting their opportunity. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, is it on this bill?
Yes.
Testimony?
Yes.
Why don't I, if I can come back to it after
Very good.
They speak, that would probably be
all right,
good.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Westrom. You'll be first on the list. I have Jeannie Fox and Kate Johansson. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jeannie Fox. I'm the Deputy Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And just briefly, we are an association of 2,000 nonprofit organizations from all corners of the state in all areas of charitable activity. And thank you for the time to speak to this bill today. Today, we are standing with, frankly, a whole host of unlikely alliances for this organization. This is the most diverse coalition we've ever been involved in, and everything from faith-based to nonprofits to private industry, and I think that is significant when a coalition this diverse, representing this many sectors, is in agreement with their opposition. And as a coalition, we're concerned that, number one, the authority is too broad. I think that has been discussed actually at quite some great length in the realm of drawing the districts and the scope of activities, what a plan entails, et cetera. The fees go unchecked for too long. And speaking solely now on behalf of the nonprofit sector, it frankly goes too far in that, in our perspective, this violates the history and the practice of exempting nonprofit organizations from property and other taxes, organizations of purely public charity who have been deemed eligible. This exemption dates back to the state constitution. It has been reviewed and affirmed repeatedly by the state legislature, most recently in 2009 with your colleagues, Senator Bach and Representative Marcourt, their leadership. And we believe this is on top of a whole proliferation of fees that look a lot like taxes that have been popping up city by city. So we, as the Council of Nonprofits, express our opposition mostly on that point. We do believe, like all other businesses and citizens, that investment is needed. I think the questions here are about how is that investment gained and by whom? We definitely would support the continued use of special assessments. In fact, nonprofits actually pay those along with other taxes like payroll. So we do contribute as well. Nonprofits who are deemed eligible for property tax exemption have to meet a bar. It's not just any nonprofit, and there are criteria for that that are defined in statute. We think it's appropriate. Cities also have to meet a bar, and that's the benefits test for the special assessments. And clearly, I don't need to go on about the property tax fund because that's been raised several times as well. So I would encourage you to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fox. Questions, members, for Ms. Fox? Senator Westrom.
Specifically, it isn't what I was going to ask before, but specifically to this witness, can you refresh for myself or the committee what do nonprofits pay for property taxes? The general property tax levy, I don't believe you're subject to. Are you subject to special assessments if a street is improved in front of a building you own? Or what is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, that is correct.
You would pay the
we
special
would pay assessment. A special assessment.
Okay, but not the general property tax.
That is correct.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you. Questions for the questions from Ms. Fox. Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we could get some clarification on that. In preparation for this bill, you know, I do have some correspondence back from some of the communities I serve that currently that nonprofits do not pay special assessments. In particular, in my community, we have the second largest university in the state. We have a technical college. We have a hospital, acres of clinics that are all tax exempt. So that's contrary to what the testimony I just heard. Is there somebody that can clarify that for us?
So Ms. Berezovsky just dashed over to the statute book. So if we can wait a minute or so.
Or Mr. Chair, I mean, if the league, I don't know if the league has any input on that or clarification. Is that something they'd be willing to address as well?
I see Ms. Finn coming to the table.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I actually don't know the answer to that question, but it sounds like, from what you're saying, that there may be a local control aspect to the collection of special assessments. But I do know that some cities specially assess tax-exempt property.
Senator Peterson.
So you're saying the state law allows some cities to assess nonprofits, and so it's a local decision whether the city will do that or not?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if it's a local decision, but I know to not assess them, but I would assume that's the case based on the fact that some cities do assess them. I don't know if that's very clear. And they also pay utility bills for the same thing that we all pay utility bills for our property that we live in.
Mr. Chair, to that point,
Senator Osmond.
In our ordinance, when we set up our complete street reconstruction system for our entire city, we actually created different types of assessment processes for in different types of property, whether it be commercial, whether it be residential. And I know that we did include churches in that. So they were under the assessment. We did not assess schools. We chose not to. But I think there's latitude in which ones you charge at the local level.
Ms. Berezovsky is
getting page here.
She's looking up the Constitution.
Mr. Chair, I'm fine waiting to get the answer if we want to move on with the testimony.
I think we have the beginnings of an answer. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, just maybe a couple of pieces of information to add to the discussion. One is that the property tax statute in 272 does list many exemptions, and among them are public schoolhouses, public hospitals, education institutions, church property, institutions of public charity. That's for the basic property tax. I tried to find some legal authority differentiating special assessments from property tax in Minnesota, and there are opinions of the Attorney General that state that that churches in particular can be required to pay special assessments. Now, as to the question of whether a local authority can exempt a church from paying a special assessment, I mean, just looking at the constitutional language in Article 10, it says the legislature may authorize municipal corporations to levy and collect assessments for local improvements upon property benefited thereby. And then it says the legislature by law may define or limit the property exempt under this section other than churches, houses of worship, and property solely used for educational purposes. So that ties the hands of the legislature in that subset of charitable organizations.
All right. Thank you. All right. Let's see. I had... Ms. Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 members, 80% of which are small businesses. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 607 today. The Chamber, along with over two dozen other groups, opposes this legislation for two simple reasons. I think those reasons have been highlighted in the committee's discussion thus far, so I won't belabor them, but rather just recap some of the concerns that this coalition has with respect to the legislation. First, we think that the legislation is too broad and that its breadth is problematic for a few reasons. First, not requiring a benefit per se from any sort of assessment would be problematic because you could have tax groups that might not even be located near a road improvement or receive a benefit that are still subject to the tax on the property to finance it. Certainly, this deviates from the traditional transportation funding principle that there should be a nexus between use and finance. Second, we're concerned about the lack of parameters around how to structure both the districts and the corresponding tax rates. Again, this goes back to the idea that you could have a district that might disproportionately burden some property owners or tax some people or some groups at higher rates than others, regardless of their use or their benefit from the proposed infrastructure improvement. And then third, we are concerned, as I think has been mentioned, about the timing. Without a sunset, these projects might be catalyzed, these assessments
assessments or levies might be catalyzed by certain projects, but not concluded at the same time as those projects, and could continue on kind of as an eternal funding mechanism, and that's a little problematic. Second, we think that this might be unnecessary. As is articulated in the handout that the committee received, there are several other tools at the local level for funding transportation improvements, and we think that it would be better to refine these tools rather than to add another tool that has the above stated problems. And with that, I'll be respectful of the committee's time because I think that you've discussed a lot of these issues already. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Ms. Johansson, questions for Ms. Johansson? Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Johansson, was wondering, particularly I was thinking about Rochester and how this might be a potential tool in its attempt for business recruitment and various infrastructure needs. Any thoughts on how this could help business?
Ms. Johansson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wieger, thank you for that question. Certainly, you know, business cares a lot about transportation infrastructure. At the same time, I think business would prefer an approach that is more holistic and broad seeking in terms of viewing how we should look at transportation funding as a state. This patchwork effect might be good for some cities or poor for others. I can't speak to Rochester, even though I am a former Rochester native, but certainly I think that business is interested in transportation, but would be very concerned and is very concerned about this legislation because of its ability to disproportionately burden businesses to pay for transportation infrastructure that they don't receive an equivalent benefit from.
And Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up, Ms. Johansson. Even with local control, you would have that concern?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wieger, yes, I think there are better ways to do it.
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum, Senator Westerman.
I'm not sure for Ms. Johansson, but I'm looking for that sheet with all those alternatives.
Here. Is it?
Okay. Thank you. I'll search.
All right. Oh, I can loan it. All right, can we go to Senator Westrom, who's on the queue? Senator Westrom. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I do have multiple questions.
Members, we're going to try to wrap this bill up by 4:30 so that we can leave the final hour for the champion bill.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little concerned that this bill maybe has a lot of work to do before we would want to send it on, but my question maybe first for the author. Under Section 2, it talks about street improvement district can charge property, but as long as it's not a property, it's not in another district. What do we do on corners? So a property that has a corner that has one street going one direction, another street going the other direction, which district would they be in?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, Ann Finn with the League of Cities. And the purpose of that is to make sure that no one is double charged. And that's our intent with that language, is to make sure that any given property would only pay one fee.
Okay.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Finn, and maybe to the author as well. I mean, we've talked about this. We've got the special assessment process already. Let me just share with you how some cities go about this. I mean, there's this push and pull, but the reason we have special assessments and provisions of protection in place are that you don't have communities or citizens with properties that are all of a sudden having an assessment that are nearly as much as the value of the property was to begin with. I have a town in my area. At this point, I'll keep their name anonymous. But in 2008, I was called. They needed legal representation because the city was doing a special assessment of about $3,000 of every property in town for the tarring of the street on the east side of town, and the west side of town was being assessed under a special assessment and got no tar. And so We talk about, the mayor, I think, talked about, oh, the people, this wouldn't happen. Well, it does happen, literally. It does happen. The resolvement of that case was the West Side people, just because it cost a lot of money to fight, they agreed to pay $1,000 towards that assessment, which the statute actually doesn't give them, the city, the right to do that. But they did. They ended up settling for $1,000 instead of a $3,000 assessment to pay for tar that didn't even benefit their property because it wasn't even in front of their property. So that does happen. And so this looks a little bit like, to me, a way around proving that there's some benefit to the project that's going forward. And I understand the conundrum, but we need to understand there's property taxpayers, and at some point they're willing to live with potholes if they have to, or a gravel street, or without curb, because at some point in a small town, I mean, you've got houses all – we just spent a bunch of time listening to affordable housing bonding projects in the Environment Economic Development Committee before this. I mean, you've got houses worth $15,000, $20,000, $10,000, $35,000. I mean – amounts that are not very expensive, but that's the value of a lot of properties across rural Minnesota. So you can't add a $10,000 or $20,000 assessment. Locally, about the same era, we had the same situation in my hometown, where there was proposed $15,000 to $30,000 assessments on properties that weren't worth much more than that, and the project eventually got stopped because the city had to prove equal benefit to the property in value, and they couldn't do that. And so I guess my question, is this just a way around meeting that threshold of special assessments, and the property taxpayers aren't going to have any way to prove benefit?
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, I think you probably made the point of the reverse, and that is that cities have tried things like this, and not like this, I'm sorry. They've tried things like you mentioned, inappropriate assessment. And I guess the only thing I would wonder is if they have the same council and mayor as they did when they tried that. I would think that that is the control of the city that they have to live with. And in this case, we're not looking at an unfair assessment. We're looking at a street improvement and maintenance, which we've seen the numbers where it actually proves that it saves money in the long run, because if you do maintain streets, they last longer. So that's the intent of this. And if it doesn't work out, that really is something that the locals need to justify to their residents. They are the elected officials. We are not the elected officials in their town. And I think that's got to be really clear that this is putting the responsibility on those local elected officials. And I guess I'd like to add one other thing, too, here that we haven't talked about, is that this is already happening. The city of St. Paul uses this system, and they've been doing this for many, many, many years. And from what I understand, it's because they have this ability in their charter. There may be other charter cities that use it also. So this really doesn't affect the city of St. Paul at all.
Okay. All right. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
So, Senator Carlson, and we kind of touched on this before, but I'm not sure I'm clear. What can be used with special assessments and a special fee district together? I mean, I think Representative Osmick brought up the point, are they going to be able to do one part of the project with the special fee and another part with the special assessment, and now people in these districts are going to get hit with a double whammy? Because ultimately, it's a cost issue, and there's only so much people can absorb. Can they use them? Are they going to be able to do both at the same time? It looks like they probably can. And maybe backing up a little bit, how are they going to charge this? Are they going to just send it out with the water bill and say $50 a month is the new street improvement fee?
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, Those are really good questions. I do anticipate that some cities would use the utility bill for this fee if they were authorized to use it. And to your second, or your other question about whether a property owner could be assessed, specially assessed, and could be subject to a street improvement fee, the answer, honestly, is probably yes. And I could see perhaps a city using a street improvement fee to do seal coat and overlay, and then if they had to do something like a sewer and water replacement, they might specially assess for that. So it really depends on how they structure the street improvement district and what all they put in the plan. If they put everything in the plan, then they could not special assess for that. But if they are only using it for certain components of their infrastructure, they could then specially assess for other components that are not included in their plan.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
To Ms. Finn, does this proposal change who can pay, and does it? It looks to me like this would be subject, and I guess the nonprofits kind of verified that with their opposition, but would they now be subject to road improvement costs that in some cases they're not paying? Is that part of the motivation behind this? And does this broaden out who's all paying and thereby bringing the cost down to some that are currently paying under special assessments? And coupled in this question, commercial rates, I'm not clear, are you going to charge commercial properties more than residential, or are you going to pay by the foot of street frontage? How, I'm not clear on that language in the bill.
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, you are correct that this would spread the cost perhaps over more properties depending on how much tax-exempt property exists. In some cities, half of their property within their boundaries is tax-exempt, so it would be a way to capture some revenue from those properties that, frankly, rely very heavily on our transportation infrastructure. I would ask Lee Gustafson to answer your question about how a city might go about structuring the rate between residential property and commercial property.
All right, thanks.
Mr. Gustafson.
Once again, Lee Gustafson, City of Minnetonka. There could be a variety of ways that the city structures this. A simple way could just be based on a zoning overlay map and have a fee that is reflective on the zoning of that parcel. So if you have a heavy industrial parcel that generates a lot of trucks and things like this, they would pay more. Obviously, a residential property, regardless of the size, would likely just pay one small fee. So there's a variety of ways it could be structured, but ultimately the city councils, I'm sure, will come up with something that is representative of how the properties are used and how much wear and tear that they put on the streets.
Okay. Thank you. Committee?
Just,
all right.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, that is exactly what we did, so I can confirm that the jurisdictions have that power. One comment to the author. Reverse referendum, I love local control, but I even like reverse referendums better. If that could be built into that, it would actually make this a better bill. One question on the plan and the adoption of the plan to Mr. Chair. This is great, except for the fact that what happens after you've adopted your plan, you have a change of city council 4 years down the road, suddenly they say, we don't like the plan, we're tossing this whole thing out. Suddenly you have a pot of money with no place to go. The statutory language doesn't really say what you're going to do if you wind up tossing everything out. So that's one question that you may want to consider if this doesn't go forward, you need to rework. And the other is a comment about cost shift. Most cities are already paying for their infrastructure. They're already paying for their maintenance. What I see this as is taking your maintenance costs out of your general spending, putting it into a new fund, which gives you the flexibility to start spending that money in other places that you weren't previously spending it. So I appreciate that, but I also think that can get cities into trouble and into areas that they shouldn't be. But I would be interested in your commentary on what happens if the plan changes or they completely scrap the plan.
Senator Carlson.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Senator Osmond, if you look at subdivision 5, the use of the fees, It says they can only be used for projects located within the district and identified in the municipal street improvement plan.
Mr. Chair, that's great. But what happens if, let's say that they say, we're going to put in this all this infrastructure here, and then a new council comes in and says, no, we're not going to do any of that. So it's not necessarily, we're not talking about the use of the fees. The use is completely gone now. What happens to the fees and the fund because there's no project anymore? I would think it would be a logistical nightmare to try and refund everybody based on the fees. I guess you could try and do it, but I think your business departments in each of the cities would have a heart attack.
It's going to have maintenance.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Osmick.
Ms. Finn.
Our intent here is that once the district is established, that they are committed to doing those projects.
Very, Mr. Chair, and that's, like I said, though, city councils change, senators change, like, you know, the priorities change. They may decide that somebody went crazy in their city hall and said, we're going to put up the Taj Mahal, and a new city council comes in and saying, after a couple of years of collecting the fees, no, we're not. So suddenly the project is gone. That's an entirely, and I've seen it happen, that's an entirely possible situation. An example of this could be putting in a cul-de-sac where the entire neighborhood freaks out after 3 years saying, we don't want you to do this, after they've been paying fees, and then the project's gone. So suddenly the fees are there, but no mechanism to return them. It's food for thought. I don't want to take all the time. Thank you.
All right. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair,
take a vote.
I'm contemplating asking to have us lay this on the table, and I really think there's some merit to here, but I do think it's something that we should work on a little more. Do you know the status of this in the House? Is it through committees there? Ms. Flynn, do you know?
Ms. Finn.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, we have made deadline in the House.
You what?
The policy committee. We've made the policy committee deadline in the House.
Yeah. Senator Westrum, we wouldn't be hearing this bill if it hadn't met policy deadline. In the House.
Well,
putting it on the table would effectively kill the bill right now.
Mr. Chair,
make your motion,
to the author, are you comfortable with the language here? Have we provided any constructive feedback, Ms. Finn and Senator Carlson? I just think there's some things that really need to be tightened up. I think a sunset could be a good idea. I just think there's issues that could be good, but also could be abused, and I've seen that happen, and I'm hesitant to pass it out as it is. I think it's got some work, it's got some potential as well.
It is going from here to taxes. We do not have to stop at finance.
Mr. Chair, if they could respond to my comments or questions.
Senator Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum. I think, yeah, we've heard some very good commentary here, but, you know, I think that there's a problem of trying to get a one-size-fits-all. I believe we have 800 cities involved here that each of them are going to have their own perspective on this. And we've talked about the hypotheticals of having a small district, a large district, and I think that's something that is in the control of the cities. I think they have very skillful people. I think, I mean, I trust the people in my cities, I know, and probably more than they trust me. And the fact of the matter is that they have to live with whatever decisions they make. The engineers have come in and they've shown me that they have street maintenance plans, and I know that in our city we have a very good plan for our long-term maintenance, and I know you didn't hear it, but we did have my city engineer come in here, actually public works director now, and he said that they are planning to use something like this because one of the reasons that they're a little bit unsure about the way we do our business, because they can't plan on LGA, they can't plan on levy limits, and they want to have a tool that's a consistent funding stream. So I think I would have to say that I think that we need to trust our cities. I think those folks have their election certificates as well as we, and they have their responsibilities.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, are you even open to a sunset clause like has been suggested, to 5 years or something like that? I mean, is that something we could add on this? assuming this is probably going to move out of here. I don't know. But I would assume that. Are you open to a sunset clause?
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, I'm open to it to a degree because we have some numbers in here that are 20 years. So I'm afraid that if we try to sunset it, that will clash with the entire purpose of this system. So I think we have to live with that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, sunsetting this provision of statute after 5 years wouldn't mean the bonds go away that they've sold for 20 years. It just means in the future the cities couldn't go forward with this unless we extend that period of time. Mr. Chair, I don't know if council could put together an oral sunset clause. I'd be interested in offering that.
Council is scribbling. And Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, we're not talking about buying bonds. This is not bonds. This is a street fund. So it's a matter of having an active fund that can be tapped for yearly maintenance, monthly maintenance, whatever you want to do. It's not going out and buying bonds and retiring a debt with these funds.
So is it, Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, Westrom. Bonds will never be used as a revenue source, and this form of revenue will not be used to pay off bonds at all?
Mr. Gustafson.
It's entirely possible. I think the intent with this legislation is just as Senator Carlson indicated, is to have a steady revenue for maintenance. Is it possible you would have a huge project within a district that it made more sense from a cost perspective to do a very large project that you didn't have enough money in the fund? Then I could see possibly a city choosing to bond for that, right, but then using this fund to pay it off. But they would make that decision based on the plan they developed, and it would likely be the most cost-effective solution for their issue at hand.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson,
Senator Westrom,
my idea of the sunset clause would be if the city hasn't adopted this in the 5 years and in the legislature doesn't extend the sunset, they're going to have operated and acted at the time the statute gave them the authority, and they're going to be able to continue. It's the scenario where cities come or constituents come forward and the legislature for some reason doesn't extend this, and I can't remember the last time we haven't extended a sunset around here in the legislative body, but it does at least force some review and accountability to how is it working? Is it doing what we intended?
I think council has just about got something ready here. Okay. Senator Pratt, members,
I'll
have to move on to the next bill here.
I'll fill the uncomfortable void, or unless Ms. Berezovsky's ready.
All right. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Gustafson has one perspective on the sunset that maybe we should share.
Mr. Gustafson.
Chair and members of the committee, the sunset clause, I think, it may work in an opposite fashion than what you're intending. If the five-year sunset date is approaching, cities may, and with no assurances of it being extended, they may actually put in place more districts than they would have if they would have had time to think about it. And you can think about newer cities and areas that have old portions and new portions. I think it may work in the opposite way. It may give cities no option, and they may actually adopt districts and put districts in place that they may have taken a longer time to think about. It may not meet what the cities are hoping to do.
All right, Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, this is a little bit long for an oral amendment. On 3.15, before the final period, insert. So it says Already, it says this section is effective July 1, 2013, and then we would insert, and expires on June 30, 2018, except as to municipal street improvement fees that were imposed before the expiration date. Municipal street improvement fees imposed before the expiration date continue until they expire by the terms of the original ordinance.
Senator Westrum, does that work for you?
That captured my intent, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Carlson, your response.
Mr. Chair, I would prefer that we not put a sunset on this, simply because then we're putting work ahead of us that we're going to have to come back and look at again. And in this case, I think that putting this into the control of the cities is the best way to go.
Senator Franz.
I'll be quick, Mr. Chair, and Senator Carlson. I know we have similar sunsets in maintenance or housing improvement districts, so I'm carrying that bill. We have the same issue, and it started as a pilot, so this might be a way to ease into it and to prove that it is doing what it's intended to do and have some legislative oversight and coming back to the legislature saying this is working and we should continue to do it. So I'd be supportive of that amendment. And most of the cities that I represent, including Edina, which has a resolution, has supported this, what you're trying to achieve. So I am supportive of your bill, given the reaction I've gotten from the cities that I represent.
Okay. All in favor of the Westrum amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion passes. Senator Carlson, do you have a motion? We're going to taxes.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, I move Senate File 607 as amended and be recommended to pass and be forwarded to taxes.
All right. Any questions on the Carlson motion? Senator Senjum?
Mr. Chair, I just want to, we babble a little bit on this one.
Senator, we have a big bill and
a lot of
we're closing in on our concluding
let
time.
Let me just say this. You go through all this, and frankly, it brings back a lot of memories as a city council member. And it won't be about a month and a half, and every city council members, or at least a lot of them, happened to me. As spring breaks up these roads, lo and behold, there it is. The phone starts ringing, and people start complaining, and it happens all over Minnesota. I don't think there's any question about that. And then you struggle as city council. How are you going to fix this? And at least in my town, and at that point 10 years ago, the city portion of the property tax covered basically the police and fire service. Yes, it's all professional, 7 days a week and so on and so forth, but you're not going to get that out of the town. So where do you pay for all this? You go to the liquor license fee, you go to parking tickets, you go to the payment in lieu of taxes for the utility, you go on and on, 150 other little sources of revenue that cities have, and you try to make it all work, but it's all kind of put together, not by what we normally think, and frankly what people normally thinking, I paid my property taxes, it's all done. Well, in many cities, there's just not enough money to do that. These streets are expensive, and yet, of course, there's an expectation that they be kept up. So, I don't like this bill a lot, but I like it enough, and so I'm going to vote for it. But it's just based on the fact that we need a tool, and I trust the fact that city council members here have an opportunity to take it or leave it. I look at the list here, and, I think most cities use them all. They might prefer special assessments as opposed to this, but that can be their choice. All the rest of these things, development agreements, that's pretty much new developments and so on. You don't get into that in an older development. I remember so well personally, Cascade Street in Rochester, 83 houses. I went door to door, $12,000 to $15,000 a house for new street construction, curb and gutter. I think 57 of those 83. Once you sit down in the living room, wanted it, but an arduous task for a city council member, but you had to do it because you wanted to be fair with them. So I just think this is one more tool, and it may or may not be a good one, but let city councils decide.
Thank you. On the Carlson motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Senator
Carlson. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Members, we are going to go long so that we can give this the Senator Champion's bill a full and fair hearing. Senator Champion, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. I know it's been a long day, but I'm going to try to move through this bill as expeditiously as possible. Senate File 927 is a statewide funding bill for transit expansion. It will allow the metro region to build out the transit system in 15 years, not 30 or more. It provides a balance between bus and rail, between urban and suburban, and includes funding to cities and counties to fund key bicycle, pedestrian, and local transit priorities. Senate File 927 also addresses the growing demand for transit in greater Minnesota. The transit build-out will greatly increase access to jobs for all Minnesotans, and particularly for those most in need. Senate File 927 will also create over 30,000 construction jobs over the next 15 years. I look forward to working with all of you to craft an omnibus transportation funding bill, hopefully that includes this statewide funding for transit, roads, and bridges. I do have an author's amendment, and so, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if you want me to move the author's amendment now and then to go through the bill. May I, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Yes, why don't we take your amendment?
I am asked the committee to adopt the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment. This is an author's amendment. We can adopt it now, and I assume you'll have testimony to these points.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Queued up? Okay, so when it comes time for testimony on these issues, we'll take it then.
Yes.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Thank you.
The first testifiers, Mr. Chair, is Mr. Van Houten and Ms. Munyon. We'll walk through details in the bill that specify where the funding comes from and what it will build and how it will operate. So if you welcome those two to the committee, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Van Houten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Van Houten. I'm with Transit for Livable Communities. We're facilitating a coalition called Transit for a Stronger Economy, and I'll be walking you through the packet. That coalition is now 51 organizations strong, representing hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans. It's a statewide coalition, includes the Minnesota Public Transit Association, 10 labor unions, future labor union members through the Summit Academy, OIC, developers, the nation's largest bicycle parts supplier located in Bloomington, Minnesota, community organizations, people with disabilities, health and environment, students, seniors, et cetera. All of these coalition members are committed and believing in the need to build out the transit system sooner rather than later to really provide all Minnesotans more transportation options. If you go to the next page in your packet, I'll, as Senator Champion described, I'll walk you through the funding mechanism for this build-out. Is a 0.75-cent increase in the regional sales tax. That would raise an additional $300 million per year. And the way we divide that up is a balance between the bus system and rail and highway bus rapid transit, so $125 million per year to the Metropolitan Council to expand the bus system and to do really critical rapid bus lines and high-frequency transit locations, as well as longer service hours, more service, all the key priorities that they would identify. Similar amount to the county's Transit Improvement Board, $125 million per year, so that we can count on building the Southwest Light Rail, the Bottineau Light Rail, and an East Metro Light Rail line still to be determined, as well as some highway bus rapid transit. Finally, something that's really unique about this bill, goes beyond the governor's plan for transit, is $50 million in return, or $50 million a year going back to local government. In three ways, to the Metropolitan Council at $9 million per year to fund regional bike and pedestrian priorities, $20.5 million to counties, and $20.5 million to cities, both on a population proportionate basis, to do priorities like sidewalks, bicycle routes, ADA compliance, as well as local transit. All of these investments are really critical, again, to building that system of transportation options. So I'm going to skip those next pieces, and Sherry will get those a little bit later. If you look on the back side of what I just described is a map of what can be built. I'm not going to take any more time on that map. I want to direct your attention to the next sheet. We call this our pennies policy brief. I think it's really important to look at the Twin Cities compared to regions, metropolitan regions that we compete with. And many of these other regions have built far more extensive transit systems, have two times the amount of light rail, commuter rail, those kind of options. And as you see here, they fund, it's very typical to fund that investment with this regional sales tax. Many regions, Denver, Dallas, Houston, San Francisco, are currently at a full cent or more. We believe the sales tax makes sense for many reasons. It grows with the economy, aligns with the service and the ridership of transit, and we already have that quarter cent sales tax in the metropolitan region. I just wanted to quickly review. You've heard in this committee about a very persuasive economic argument for more transit. The Itasca project, CEOs in this region commissioned a return on investment study of this acceleration of building out our transit system. What they found is for every dollar invested, we would see $3 in direct economic benefits to our region. This is reduced traffic delays for everyone who commutes in the region. This is reduced auto costs for people who are able to use transit. This is reduced travel times for people who are shipping goods across our regions. I think the other thing you heard when the economic case was made is that site selectors who look out around the country, the world, where they might select a corporate expansion, nowadays they want to see your transit map, not just your roadmap, but your transit map. So those two features are really the essence of the economic argument. What I want to share with you today and sort of set up for the testifiers that will follow is that building a stronger economy is really about doing that for everyone. And it really gets down to what does that look like in your district on the street. So we know that transit creates jobs. That's critical in this economy, 30,000 jobs with the build-out of the system. We know, as I mentioned, that transit provides an alternative to traffic congestion. We also know or should know that transit is really critical to providing equitable access for those who either don't drive, people with disabilities, seniors, or those who can't afford a car. Our estimate is only about 25% of the households in the Twin Cities region have access to convenient transit. We really need to change that to give people affordable options. Finally, these options, transit, biking, and walking that I've mentioned, provide healthy options for all Minnesotans and a healthy option for our natural environment. Just a couple of things to close. I've been in this business, transportation field, for about 20 years, and well, transportation planning is really about planning for future demand. And right now, we need to pay attention that the demand is shifting. When available, Minnesotans are flocking to transit, biking, and walking option. And this is particularly true with the next generation. You know, I could go into more detail, but study after study shows that the young people really are embracing these alternatives and are less inclined to get a driver's license, less inclined to be driving. Transit for Livable Communities administered a federal program in Minneapolis and adjoining communities called Bike Walk Twin Cities. It was a six-year program. Over that time period, we saw the increase in biking by 51% and an increase in walking by 24%. I know you've already heard this in committee, but there's going to be two times the number of seniors in 20 years and a greater immigrant population. Both of those trends lead to more demands for transit. So to conclude, the essence of this bill is about creating more convenient and safe options for transit, biking, and walking. The coalition believes that we can't afford not to invest. We are in economic competition with those other regional peers, and this is the kind of investment that makes sense to grow our economy. I'll just close with a couple of more data points. We conducted a statewide survey earlier this year in January. And Minnesotans really embraced this investment plan. 91% of Minnesotans statewide said that transit is a smart investment. 69% thought that this bicycling and walking component ought to be a component of a transportation funding package that gets done this year. And a majority are supporting a regional sales tax. So we're convinced that this particular legislation, Senate File 927, it saves money for households and businesses, reduces congestion, provides critical options, and really needs to move forward. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Van Hattem. Questions, members? Ms. Munyon.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Sherry Munyon. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Public Transit Association. This is a statewide coalition of transit systems, providers, and transit advocates. The mission of the Minnesota Public Transit Association is to support transportation alternatives that improve the quality of life for people in communities large, small, urban, suburban, and rural. Following up briefly on Mr. Van Haddam's comments, MIPTA is supportive of the metropolitan components of this bill, in particular because of the infusion of new revenues for the bus service as well as the transitways. With a 4% growth, we think that will begin going a long way to meeting the needs that are unmet today. And one of the complaints that we have frankly heard as we've been meeting with members of the legislature this year is that there is not enough service, that it's not meeting every legislator's district. The backbone of the transit system is the bus and will remain the bus, and we think this is a key component of the bill. Local needs that are unmet today are also addressed partially with this bill, and it's the only bill that provides funding for that. This will help our local communities meet their individual needs. With that, I'm going to turn my comments to Greater Minnesota and remind everyone that transit is critical statewide. In 2012, we had 59 Greater Minnesota transit systems, and they provided 11.5 million rides. 50% of those transit riders are going on the bus 5 days a week. 33% of those are going to work, and 20% of those riders are going to school. I think that's important to keep in mind. If you recall, we have a statute, and in Minnesota, MnDOT's transit plan and then language and statute calls for MnDOT moving towards the unmet needs. The 2001 transit plan called for moving steadily toward meeting the transit needs in Greater Minnesota with an attainment of just 80% of those needs by 2010 and 90% by 2020. But implementation of those goals has fallen drastically behind, due primarily to the lack of state funding. So the result of that was to change the plan. Now the goals are to meet 80% attainment of service needs by 2015 and 90% attainment of those needs by 2025. Where are we today? For comparison, we're at 59%. We're meeting 59% of the needs today. In most communities in Greater Minnesota, transit service ends in the late afternoon or by early evening. There is no service for second and third shifts for most of Minnesotans outside of the metropolitan area. We still have two counties in this state who have absolutely no transit service at all, while we have eight other counties that have just transit service in selected municipalities of the county. These gaps undermine the basic mobility for Minnesota residents. The bill before you will provide an annual infusion of about $30 million a year. These revenues will come from the leased vehicle revenues currently going into the general fund. We consider them a transportation purpose and believe they should be used for Greater Minnesota Public Transit. The $30 million a year will meet 70% of the needs for Greater Minnesota transit mobility and economic prosperity. With me today, there will be another testifier representing a Greater Minnesota transit system who will tell you more individually. But I would like to call your attention to a graph in your chart, because while we're here today seeking for new revenues so that we can expand and enhance service throughout the state of Minnesota, we're actually facing severe consequences in the short-term future without any new revenues. In Greater Minnesota, our peak will be in 2015, and annually thereafter, we expect a reduction of service hours throughout the state because our current revenue stream will not be able to maintain existing service. I know time is short. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
So, Ms. Munyon, I missed it when you said, How much revenue do we get to Greater Minnesota Transit in this bill, and how close does it get us to the need?
The actual amount is $32 million for 70% of the need.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Ms. Munyon? Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, and this is actually more to staff, would it be possible for us before the end of the week to get a complete listing of all the sales taxes that are established in each one of the seven counties so that we know what we're dealing with here? Right now, we know we have a state sale, we have a sales tax, we have the twins tax, we have a new tax here, we have a quarter cent on. I'd appreciate a listing of each one of the seven counties.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Munyon? All right. Senator Champion.
With that, Mr. Chair, I would like to call testifiers Tony Kellum, and then also if I could have Lewis King from Seminole IC come to my right.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairman Dibble and members of the committee. I am Tony Kellen. I'm the Director of Operations at St. Cloud Metrobus for the past 27 years. I'm also on my eighth year as a volunteer president for the Minnesota Public Transit Association. I do have a handout that should be going around. Looks like this.
Thank you.
We're not going to be using this entire handout, but I leave it for your reference. This is a presentation that I've been doing in a number of committees, starting back with testimony with TFAC several months ago. So you could probably immediately flip to the back of that sheet. So anyway, thank you for the opportunity to speak today about the importance of public transit funding for Greater Minnesota and the system that I represent, St. Cloud Metrobus. Demand for transit service is growing in St. Cloud as it is across all of Greater Minnesota. In the St. Cloud metro area and other urban areas, we continue to receive requests for additional transit services. The same requests sometimes coming forward two and three times that we haven't been able to address. For example, in the St. Cloud area, we have a mobile home park that was recently annexed into the community of Waite Park, which we represent. We're trying to figure out a way to provide service out there, but we frankly don't have the funding to do it. In 2001, when MVES was introduced as a funding mechanism for transit as a measure of reducing property taxes in the local areas, we began to see a continual slide in funding, or MnDOT's ability to participate in the overall state share of funding for transit services. This isn't unique to St. Cloud. It's pretty much statewide in Greater Minnesota. In the first year after the bill was passed, or the property tax replacement aid was passed, the state was not able to participate in $270,000 of St. Cloud's growing service. That has now peaked to almost $2 million in the 2013 calendar year budget. Statewide, and this is a figure that is often not talked about, $8 million, or nearly 12% of the entire Greater Minnesota transit budget, MnDOT does not participate in their full share of the state funding formula. I was asked the question, what does $30 million provide? What does $32 million provide? And so many times people have a hard time wrapping their hands around what that really means. So I just did a really very simple calculation that I've been using as a talking point. And it's on the back side of the sheet that I handed out, page 2, the second set of bullets. Currently, there's about a million service hours in calendar year 2012, $63 million of operating cost. So if you just do some basic simple math, the plan calls for $1.6 million in service hours. So there's about 500,000 service hours that are not provided to get us to that 80% plan goal. That's cost per service hour is around $60 an hour, so $500,000 hours at $60 is $30 million. That figure then can be broken down further. We have about 250 weekdays of service. If you break it down, it turns out to be about 4 bus routes per operation for all of Greater Minnesota. I just got a 1 minute time here, so I'm going to move quickly. What can be accomplished? Again, Sherry already mentioned this in her testimony. A lot of underserved areas, a lot of no evening service, no weekend service. There's plenty of need that can be met out there. So in conclusion, with higher gas prices, Minnesotans are looking for options to get to work, to get to school, and other destinations, but our transit systems in Greater Minnesota continue to struggle with limited funding and increasing fuel, health care, and other costs. The state needs to finally invest more fully in expanded transit service to meet the needs of the citizens in greater Minnesota. The investment will pay dividends and make our local communities places where people can remain independent in their homes, productive, and living in all parts of our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kellen. Questions, members?
Senator Mr. Kiffmeyer. Chairman, I don't have a particular question for this testifier. So are we going to finish all the testifiers and then go to member questions in general about the bill? Is that the plan?
Yeah, I think that would be best. We'll pause for questions from the testifier that are specific
to the
testifier.
Well, my question is specific for the author.
Okay. Related to greater Minnesota service.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Champion, my question for you, and maybe Ms. Barashovsky might also be helpful in this regard. On the amendment you placed on this bill, Section 5 of the A1 Amendment, can you tell me, is this language here, preferential hiring or, let's see, what does it say here? Anyway, does this Section 5 apply only to what's in this bill, or does it affect things in a broader context? Maybe Ms. Barashovsky could answer that. I can't tell for sure.
Ms. Barashovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, as I read this, I believe that it applies to all transit and transportation infrastructure projects. Does that answer your question? Or
yes, it does. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have, as the next testifier, Mr. Lewis King, who's the president of Summit OIC. He will speak to, amongst other things, the importance of the amendment and specifically transportation infrastructure hiring and recruitment of women, people of color, the folks with disabilities as well. So please, Mr.
Welcome,
Lewis
Mr. King.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having and members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me today. My organization, the people I represent, I'm Lewis King. I'm the president of Summit Academy OIC and the founder of Hire Minnesota, an acronym for Healthcare Infrastructure and Renewable Energy. We believe the best social service program in the world is a job. We support this measure because not only will it improve our infrastructure so that we can remain a vibrant and competitive region, it will provide tens of thousands of construction jobs and prepare our workforce for the future. And as I'll share with you in a moment, I'll be able to answer why this is needed as a matter of necessity rather than preference. We believe that it is imperative that low-income people and women and people of color have equal access to these jobs and position us so that we can replace the aging baby boomers. We are also pleased that the bill, and as the measure outlines, encourages the governmental partners to make every effort to ensure members of these communities are hired to work on these projects. Over the past 4 years, we've made great progress in helping MnDOT, Met Council, several counties and cities to institute hiring programs to reach these underrepresented populations. In doing so, we've blazed new career pathways in construction trades for members of our future workforce. And I'll make note here that in the past 4 years, we've seen MnDOT's minority participation grow from roughly 6% to 9% because of measures like this. And mind you, prior to last year, the participation goals were 11%. And so it's taking these types of measures to get the progress to move forward, and we want to maintain this momentum. The demographic projections and future trends in the construction trades demonstrate a critical need to develop a more sophisticated, flexible, and predictable hiring program to maximize efforts to hire qualified workers so that we can keep our system strong. The fact is, many of our trades have up to 25% of their members are over 50. Many of them would have retired a few years ago, but because of the Great Recession, they're continuing to work. As we approach 2020, though, the number of people who will reach retirement age will grow by 44%. At the same time, the populations of color will increase by a third. So putting these types of measures will give us a deliberate strategy to ensure that not only matters of equity are addressed, but we also have the necessary people to maintain our infrastructure and keep us strong. Thank you for having me before you today.
Thank you, Mr. King. Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, I supported your amendment going on as a courtesy, as we often do. And as I'm looking through this, I'm concerned a little bit about, as we know, the skilled labor builds these projects, and I sell concrete block, quite frankly, and we have a shortage of bricklayers. And so I'm wondering, is there a chance that these projects would be delayed at all in terms of the labor that would be required? And I just happen to notice that Mr. Werke from the AGC, or Associated General Contractors, in the room. Mr. Chair, would you consider allowing him to comment on the ability to recruit these workers and have the workforce available to complete this these types of projects? Is that possible?
Sure. Allow Senator Champion to respond. Looks like Mr. Werke is making his way forward.
Mr. Chair and Senator, if you look at line 1.26, it says the lead transportation authority shall make every effort. We think it's important to have an intentional plan to try to make sure that you are including women, people of color, and the disabled and veterans. And so the reason why it's not a directive but more enabling is because we want to make sure that the guiding principles are there, that there is an expectation that they're going to do everything within their power to make sure that they are including these various populations. Now, the other thing that I think is important is because as we begin to think about how do we alleviate or provide some relief to our safety net programs, the only way to do that is if we're being intentional about including these groups into the revenue stream. And so I think it's important to really make sure that we're doing everything on our end in order to make sure that we are reaching out to these different groups and different populations.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, and Senator Champion, I agree 100% that they should make every effort. My concern, following up on Senator Peterson's question, is line 1.30. It goes on to say, in addition, the lead transportation authority shall contract with a community-based employment assistance firm to create an employment program to recruit, hire, and retain women and minorities for the project construction workforce. Can you explain what that means? Because that language says shall and not shall make every effort.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Senator Miller. If you look at the transition that happens there, there is more of a directive around that notion because this is for community-based employment assistance programs. So that is to say, hey, there are community-based assistance programs in every community. And when you think in terms of those community assistance programs being engaged in order to make sure that there is talking amongst the various key stakeholders and that we are truly providing a pipeline or an opportunity for these individuals to come into that that employment assistance firm, and then for that firm to link them with a potential possibility. And so it's women and people of color, it's veterans as well. Because a part of what we hear constantly whenever we think in terms of these targeted groups, that there isn't enough communication or any outreach to them. And so I think it's important for there to be some push around making sure that they connect with an organization that can reach out to these target populations. But there is nothing that says, for an example, that they are required to hire at a certain place or space. Now, we want them to hire, but we want to make sure that there is the pool that's there, because most people complain by saying, I don't know of any other people of color. I don't know where I can find these folks. So we think it's important to have this intentional effort as a part of the plan in order to make sure that we are providing relief to our safety net programs by creating opportunities for people to be employed.
Senator Miller.
Mr. Chair, and just a follow-up to that. So this is on any or every transportation project throughout the state. They'd have to follow this new language. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
And Senator Miller, yes.
Senator Champion, I'm not sure that that's the case. I think it's in it says the lead transportation authority shall contract with a community-based employment assistance firm to create an employment program to recruit, hire, and retain women and minorities for the project construction workforce. Is that parceled out to each project, or is that to create an overall program for the purpose of deploying folks into, I guess we call it the horizontal construction field?
Mr. Chair, my understanding, it is to contract with a transportation authority will contract with a community-based organization. And it is, from my vantage point, in order to make sure that there's an opportunity for this community-based organization to develop pools of people to be available for any transportation-related project. So that would mean, but it leads, but it provides enough leadway in order for them to figure out exactly what that looks like and what that means.
All right. Very good. Thanks,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Then it seems as though we need this to have, if you're going to make a mandate here and you're going to mandate from the contract, that's a cost. That costs money to do that. It's not free. It's going to cost. And all these lead transportation authorities of counties and cities and towns and state level, all these other things, this is going to cost money. So where's this money going to come from?
Mr.
And
Chair,
should we have a fiscal note on this then?
Mr. Chair, Mr. King would like to speak first, and then I'll follow up.
Mr. King.
Mr. Chair. Senator, I don't have my glasses on.
Kiffmeyer,
thank you.
Senator.
Many of these things are practices that are already in effect, and as Mr. Werke can attest, we worked jointly to develop over the last few years with MnDOT. The fact of the matter is MnDOT gets money from the federal government to do things like this. I hold contracts with them. We need deliberate strategies, which we've not had in the past, to develop our workforce. We didn't invent the hiring goals. They're there. We've never met them for lots of reasons. But one reason is we've not had relationships to reach into the communities where these people exist. And without a plan, without resources and finances to make it happen, we still wouldn't make progress. We've worked for the last 4 years, and we're going to do it on the ballpark authority, and we'll continue to do it into the future. Here, as I view this, we're codifying efforts that have been underway by practitioners who set down labor, business groups, as well as government to figure out how do we bridge the gap that exists. And it's not necessarily this isn't a deal around monitoring and compliance. This is about human capital development because the world around us is changing. And workforce, even as I've defined it, no longer is just African Americans who we formerly defined as diversity. It's also immigrants and others. These are the young people who are coming behind us. These types of measures will ensure that they can fill the boots of people who are leaving the industry and that our infrastructure will not lag in development, and we will continue to be leaders in this region.
All right, Mr. Werke, briefly we've got
Mr. Chairman,
a bunch of more folks who need to testify. So,
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. I'm Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors. Caught a little bit off guard here. I wasn't planning on seeing something like this today, and this is the first time I've seen it. And I'm not an expert on employment in hiring, but I will try to address a few of the issues. Mr. King and Senator Champion are, I first want to say, are absolutely correct that there are challenges that are facing the industry moving forward in terms of demographics, in terms of training, in terms of people that simply just want to work in the construction industry. And we have been dealing with trying to get ahead of the curve on those challenges with the broad collaborative group that many of you have heard about. With respect to the amendment and listening to the discussion, I am a little concerned in hearing the interpretation that Section 5 is more expansive than just talking about transit or transit project in particular. A couple things about contractor hiring. Contractors typically do not undertake a practice of hiring from a particular area or, in fact, a particular neighborhood or zip code. I mean, the transportation workforce is a transitory workforce that moves all around the state, all around the region, for that matter of fact. The second concern, and again, I'm getting a little out over my expertise here, I think as Senator Miller pointed out in sections beginning with 130 through 134, I think that treads dangerously close to prescribing particular training programs from which contractors may be required to hire. I know of instances in the past where that has been tried, and the federal government has said that if there are federal funds on the project, that that's not allowed. Contractors are obligated to hire the most qualified individual, regardless of race or other factors. And you know, I'm not here for with a purpose to denigrate Senator Champion's amendment or to be a stumbling block. I just think there are some things here, and the questions that have been asked are good questions.
Thank you. Anything? Thank you, Mr. Werke. Senator Peterson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure the intent of this bill or Senator Champion. Were you going to move this bill today?
I'm going to lay it on the table. Oh, Senator Peterson.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Senjum?
It seems like the bill came to the table as a transportation bill, and now it's an employment policy bill. And I'm just sitting here thinking whether the Jobs Committee ought to have some take on this. This is a major policy shift, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We're going to move on with testimony. Kit Richardson, Rachel Callanan.
Mr. Chair, if we could start with Assad.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because he has to leave right away.
All right.
And we are concerned about the time, so I'm asking the testifiers to give us an abbreviation of their testimony.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Senator DeBell. My name is Assad Al-Wade. I'm Executive Director of New American Academy. I work with immigrants in the southwest area of the Twin Cities, East African, Somali immigrants, and other low-income communities there. I support, on behalf of my organization and the community that we work on this bill. The reason we support it is because we believe not only the southwest area, but the broader Minnesota public transportation system will benefit to all community, especially it will affect to our community in Eden Prairie, because it will help us to have a good access to education, universities, healthcare systems, all are in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis or St. Paul. It will help our community to go to healthcare systems, hospitals, and it will also connect neighborhoods. And so good accessible transportation system in the state of Minnesota would also impact to our economy directly and indirectly. So that's why we support this bill. And that's why we are here today, to let our voice be heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hollywood. Any questions, members? All right, Ms. Callanan.
Great. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Callanan, and I'm Regional Vice President of Advocacy for the American Heart Association. I also chair the Minnesotans for Healthy Kids Coalition. Both organizations support this legislation and are part of the coalition. The Minnesotans for Healthy Kids Coalition is a statewide coalition that focuses on addressing childhood obesity. And that's why I'm here to talk with you today, is to talk about the health impacts of this legislation. So the lack of physical activity is one of the key preventable risk factors for heart disease and stroke, along with a host of other chronic diseases, obesity, diabetes, cancer. Studies show that use of public transit is associated with more walking. The amount of walking is significant enough that it could help reduce the obesity epidemic and its related costs, which brings me here today. Obesity is a public health problem that has reached epidemic proportions. Over 68% of U.S. adults are obese or overweight. We're doing a little bit better in Minnesota. 62% of Minnesota adults are obese or overweight. But childhood obesity has tripled in the last several decades. And this has created such a problem that this really is the first generation of children that will have lower life expectancies than their parents. So that's one of the dramatic impacts. How does this bill help? Well, first, public transit and the bike walk provisions in the bill can have a substantial impact on meeting physical activity needs and reducing obesity. Increased access to public transportation may provide more opportunities for physical activity, as most transit trips begin and end with walking. The research calls this type of physical activity transit walking. I didn't know there was a term for it, but there is. The Surgeon General recommends adults get at least 30 minutes of physical activity every day. Almost half of American adults do not get that recommended physical activity. However, public transit users spend an average of 19 minutes each day walking to and from transit. Studies have concluded that walking to and from public transportation can help physically inactive people meet the recommended level of daily physical activity. Studies have shown that obesity is associated with time spent in cars. The simple act of getting out of your car and walking or biking can have a very positive impact on health. The second reason that our coalition and the Heart Association support this bill is that the investment in this bill in creating more opportunities and linkages to walk and bike makes getting out of your car a real choice. And for some, it may become your first choice. I will just mention that I did not get my driver's license until I was 30 years old. That's when I had child number two, and it became impractical to bike and walk and take public transit with two little kids. It was great when I could strap them on the backpack, but with two, I couldn't do that. The American Heart Association estimates that if current obesity trends continue, total health care costs attributable to obesity could exceed $861 billion by 2030. I have to repeat that number because it's pretty amazing. $861 billion by 2030 attributed to obesity health care costs. In conclusion, obesity and lack of physical activity continue to be a problem. Improvements to our public transit system and investment in bike walk infrastructure in this bill provide lifelong opportunities to incorporate physical activity into our daily lives. Simply walking 30 minutes a day can have a positive impact on your health and in turn can help reduce health care costs. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kalina. Questions, members? All right. Thank you, Ms. McKnight. Welcome.
Next testifier is Kenya McKnight, and she has some comments about the bill, but also about the importance of community engagement.
Right. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Kenya McKnight. I am a resident of North Minneapolis and District 59. I'm also a member of the Metropolitan Council Transportation Advisory Board and work with local communities around basic transit things. Just an interesting point of view for you is that in the regional policy world that I work with in government, I get to see a lot of incredible work being done around assessing and evaluating transit needs Metropolitan Council, MAC, as well as MnDOT and others, looking at strategies to work with communities, to think about setting different standards for how to increase livability within communities through transit developments and improvements. And then the other side of it is that there's no real funding to support that. I look at things like the streetcar initiatives, the bus rapid transit, the walkable communities with stronger bike paths, with better sidewalks and other infrastructure, improved lighting for safety. There's a number of different things that touches the world of transit outside of trains and buses, right? But those are essential and important. And our governments that we depend on to do this work 24/7 are doing all these studies and working very hard, trying to develop even new models for community engagement, how to talk to people, how to listen to people, how to communicate this very difficult language and processes of transportation to the common people in rural and metropolitan areas in Minnesota. And most of all, how to create a world-class transit system that serves our entire state, that, yes, people of color and people with disabilities benefit from. By the way, who also are the largest transit users within our metropolitan area. So it's not about, for me, so much of this being a free ride or folks looking for jobs. It's about a return on the investment that people make from the money that goes into using the transit system, from number one, that's going to be used to also expand it. So folks are paying into this, and we're wanting a return on our investment. And the best way to get it is for government to continue to work with communities and figure out ways to engage us, to think about different strategies, tactics, and models to create this world-class transit system that will set our state and region up to be a competitor nationally and perhaps a standard for what livable transit communities should look like in our nation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McKnight. Questions for Ms. McKnight, members? All right. Thank you very much. Excellent.
And our final testifier will be Sarah Mullins from Isaiah.
Welcome, Ms. Mullins.
Thank you, Chair, for having me here. My name is Sarah Mullins. I am here representing Isaiah. We've been working on transit for over 10 years and been part of the Transit Coalition with the funding we did the last time around. Our organization is a coalition of about 100 congregations in the Twin Cities and St. Cloud and Rochester areas. And we have, as people of faith, are looking at a prophetic vision for Minnesota that focuses on our call from God to put people at the center of everything that we do. And our involvement in transit funding is really central to the idea that access to opportunity means that everyone needs to get around, including those unable to drive, and that a stable, adequate transit system is core to creating a Minnesota that provides opportunity to all of its residents. And our efforts, both in funding and with the policymakers at the agencies over the last decade, has really been to use these infrastructure investments as a positive force to shape our communities. So for that reason, we support the bill. We support the $300 million metro area and the $32 million for Greater Minnesota and the funding mechanisms that that are detailed within. Over the last decade, the bus service, there's been a lot more energy, you know, that has come about around the transitways, and we're very excited about the the construction of Central Corridor and the emerging corridors. The thing I just want to provide a little urgency around from our perspective is the bus service. We hear day in and day out. I was listening to Tony Kellen and thinking, you know, it's actually, I believe it's just over 6 years today that we were in St. Cloud having a hearing about the transit needs out there. And we had people from that mobile home park who were talking about having to walk 2 miles to get to the closest bus station. And here we are 6 years later, and the problem isn't resolved. And it's heartbreaking to hear the stories over and over again and to get into better relationships with the transit providers and still hear that their hands are tied because the budget isn't stable. And that's what we hear from them over and over and over. It's not stable. And so how can we plan for a route expansion? How can we plan for a service expansion? The last thing they want to do is plan for that and then have to pull it back because the annual funding came up short. So that is the prime reason that we support such a dedicated source of funding and an aggressive funding with the 4% annual increase is really a sizable chunk to move to enable those transit providers to be able to really plan to do the stuff that Kenya was talking about, really get in with the community and make transit work and provide that hope that we're on a progression. We're not going to have the rug pulled out from underneath us just because the legislature changes or because the other factors that make some of the general fund kind of stuff unstable. So lastly, I'll just say that we would really like to see you propel the transit service to a new level and look forward to working with everyone when that happens.
Thank you, Ms. Mullins. Questions for Ms. Mullins? Senator Champion.
And Mr. Chair, that's the last testifier, and I hope that you've had a chance to listen to some of the things that have been presented. If you have any questions, we'll be happy to answer those. And in between now and even once the omnibus bill comes forward, if there's some suggested language or changes that one would suggest, I am always open to that. I think that the amendment as well as the bill sort of articulates some guiding principles that I hope that this committee would take very seriously. When we think in terms of inclusion, when we think in terms of true community engagement, when we think in terms of the importance of transportation and a comprehensive transportation system, I think it's important for us to wrestle with some of these tough issues, and I'm always open to ideas and suggestions.
Thank you. I know at least one more person in the audience would like to testify, so I'll call for additional testimony at this point. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. James Clark with the Messalina and Kramer, representing the Suburban Transit Association. And, Mr. Chair, very briefly, I know the committee has heard a lot of testimony. We just want to mention that we appreciate the comprehensive nature of this bill. Particularly, it was just mentioned the 4% growth in the bus system is very very critical to the Suburban Transit Association. I think you do have a packet in your – or a handout in your packet that – lists, again, the membership of the Suburban Transit Association. And specifically, thanks, Senator Champion, for the reference to Suburban Transit Providers on line 3.2 of the bill. And, Mr. Chair, if it is appropriate, the Vice Chair of the Suburban Transit Association, Jeff Waji, would just like to make a brief comment
please.
As well.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Waji. I am the Vice Chair of the Suburban Transit Association. I am also a member of the Plymouth Advisory Committee on Transit. A couple of the charts that we just wanted to point out real briefly is just the need and the growth of transit use of our providers in the different cities. If you look in terms of the chart that shows suburban ridership from 1990 to present, you'll note significant increases in ridership from 1990 to 2010. And then the green bar that is on there shows the increase in ridership over the two-year period from 2010 to 2012. And so as the suburban areas has expanded, we've seen significant use and increase in transit. As it continues to expand in our member cities, we're going to continue to see that. And direct you to the next page, which talks about population growth in our member cities as well as employment growth. If we note from 2010 to 2030, we're looking at projected population growth from 525,000 to 693,000.
I think of equal importance is looking at projected employment growth for that same period. If you're looking from 2010 to 2030, going from 282,000 jobs to 422,000 jobs. And I know we see companies such as United Health Group, Target, creating these campuses out in the communities based in large part upon where transit is projected to be built. And I know in Plymouth itself, 20% of our ridership is reverse route commuters that are actually coming into Plymouth to work in Plymouth. And that's an important concept. And so in the other piece, in terms of expanding the bus service, Plymouth recently added an additional bus. We felt we were not providing sufficient service to the demand during peak ridership and the peak hours, so we added another bus into that to run some time slots in the morning and some time slots in the afternoon. That one bus, adding that one bus from our Station 73 in eastern Plymouth, is going to cost us another $100,000. So you can kind of multiply that, you know, about expanding bus service, the need for that type of funding just based on that one route and the cost of adding that one bus into the system. With that, I will stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions, members? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate File 927? All right. Any questions, members? Anything for Senator Peterson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just had a comment, I guess, and a question, or maybe from the standpoint, I don't know if you're in a position to give the committee any sense of your direction yet. I think the assumption is this is kind of your first step in building the transportation financing bill. And
yeah, and we're going to hear the bill proposed by Representative Earhart that I'm co-authoring when we return, as well as the governor's bill, and then we'll compile a committee bill from that.
I think the question I have, or maybe I think the committee might appreciate, or at least I would, if you have a sense in terms of, I think this bill, we heard testimony raised about $300 million of new money for transit, and do you have a sense for what kind of new money you might be looking to try and generate for roads and bridges as well at this point? Is it going to be equal? Is it going to be less? Is it going to be more?
We will definitely have a statewide bill that, yeah, absolutely, that hopefully will garner 201 votes in the legislature.
Okay.
trying to find our path, and I'm taking advice. So everyone who needs my cell phone, I will give it to them so we can talk over the break. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Anything further, members? Senator Champion?
Just a motion to lay this bill on table.
Senator Pratt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to kind of go along with Senator Senjum's idea. I think there, especially with the amendment, it changes the focus of the bill a little bit, not just to be pure transportation, but really about jobs and work and develop workforce development. Prior to inclusion in the omnibus bill, I would like to recommend we send it to Senator Tomasoni's committee and have them review the new sections with Senator Champion.
Well, why don't we wait for the bill, Senator Pratt, before we get too anxious? And the bill may whatever is in the bill, it's not uncommon for omnibus funding bills to make a couple of stops.
Okay.
Taxes will want to take a look, no doubt. It's a little foreshadow there, stuff that's going to be in the bill. There'll be stuff in the bill that other committees may need to take a look at. So, if a committee does have legitimate jurisdiction over some element, if it's this that gets included or some other, they'll absolutely make those stops on its way to the floor. But I appreciate the perspective. Senator Champion, concluding remarks.
Just want to get the support of the committee, especially as we build the omnibus bill, because I believe that this bill in its entirety is great. But in the event that some have some anxiety, I understand that too, and we can always work to craft language so that it's much more palatable as you swallow.
All right. Thank you. With that, we'll lay Senate File 927 on the table for possible inclusion, and this committee is adjourned.